Good afternoon. On behalf of LaRouche PAC, I'd like to welcome all of you to today's seminar. Just in introducing our speaker, I think that all of us are aware that just as in the wake of the Great Depression of 1929, Europe and the United States are today similarly menaced by a wave of fascist threats in both Europe and the United States. The problem is that while those of us gathered here today may be aware of that, the ranks of political leadership on both sides of the Atlantic seem to be painfully unaware of it. It is nowhere in the discussion among U.S. presidential candidates, nor is it in the discussion among European heads of state. In 1929, we had the benefit of a Franklin Delano Roosevelt to address precisely that threat and to lead the United States and the rest of Europe to safety. Today, that figure is represented solely by the personality of the U.S. statesman and economist Lyndon LaRouche. There probably is no better time, no more critical moment than this one, for Mr. LaRouche to address the citizens of the United States, citizens internationally, and leaders, especially here in the U.S., who must begin to cope with the full danger of the threat immediately before us. And so, without really any further introduction, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, what I'm going to present today, in order to be an effective presentation of what's important to be heard, is far-ranging in some respects, and therefore, with some pre-calculation, I have sorted out how much I will say here, pending the question period, to a number of topics which are essentials. That leaves out many things that many people do not know which are pertinent to these subjects. However, much of what is needed to be known, which I will not introduce here in the opening remarks, is already available in several sources, public sources, largely through the Internet, through EIR itself, a magazine, which weekly, and also through the LPAC website, particularly the research features of it as well, more than even the current breaking developments. And my own work in these areas, in EIR, and in the published in the website, as longer articles, feature articles, do cover in depth the principal considerations which everyone must know in order to competently address the subject before me. Now, to indicate the nature of this, I start by saying something I shall qualify in the course of these remarks. First of all, Felix Rohatyn is guilty of something tantamount to high treason against the United States in the fact that he is supposedly a citizen of the United States but is working, to my knowledge, with sources which are intent on destroying the United States. And therefore, the man is a traitor and should be regarded as such by any honest citizen who is not absolutely stupid. But to understand that, to call him a traitor, which I'm not calling him here, I say what he's doing is tantamount to treason. Because the conviction of treason requires the evidence of his actually being in cahoots with somebody, and I have the evidence. But it's not in the form that the ordinary citizen would immediately understand it without a lot of explanation. But the man is guilty of a crime of implicit treason by virtue of the intention which he has expressed and by virtue of the international forces which he's operating with in the attempt to destroy the United States by his program. With that, I shall proceed. Now, the difference now, as was already referred to this by Debbie, is that in 1932, particularly in March 1933, on the day that President Franklin Roosevelt first entered his office and found nary a pencil in the office with which to begin governing, And on that day, he called, according to the historian's records, he called the two secretaries in from the outer office and began to dictate the outlines of action, which saved the United States. What he did was he worked against a party whose leadership then as today was working for fascism. That is, the Democratic Party leadership of the period 1929 to 1932, despite Roosevelt's candidacy, was actually working to install a fascist program of government in the United States comparable to that which was then installed in Germany. Remember, just a few days before, Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated as President of the United States. Adolf Hitler, who had been put into power in Germany by the British, had been installed as the dictator, not just the chancellor, but the dictator of Germany, given constitutional dictatorial powers by an overthrow of the German constitution. And under these conditions, Roosevelt entered office on the day he actually occupied that office, when World War II had been made inevitable. And in response to that challenge, Franklin Roosevelt led not only in the recovery of the United States, but mobilized the United States as it never had been mobilized before to become the greatest power this planet had ever known in economics and in military power. And through that mobilization, he saved the nation and he saved civilization from the virtually eternal persistence of fascism from abroad, which had been set up by the British. At the end of the war, or before the end of the war, when Roosevelt had died, he had a successor, Harry Truman, who came in. Harry Truman was working for the other side, not as a traitor, but actually working with the ideas of Winston Churchill. And therefore, President Roosevelt's intentions for the post-war period had been expressed in several forms. Number one, the Bretton Woods fixed exchange rate system. The world economy was destroyed as an economy. Only the United States represented power then, real economic power, as well as military power. Therefore, Roosevelt was committed to eliminate empire, including the British Empire especially. And he said many times to Churchill and others during the course of the war, "Winston, when this war has ended, your imperialist system is going to end. The colonies will be freed. We will free them. We will help them develop as independent states. We will organize a United Nations organization as a vehicle for bringing nations back together in cooperation according to the Treaty of Westphalia, the Westphalian Principle, and in order to eliminate imperialism entirely from this planet, and to have instead a planet which is composed of sovereign nation states, each working in sovereignty to a common aims of mankind." When Roosevelt died, that ended. No Truman or no one else could suddenly reverse the effect of Roosevelt, even though the conservative tendency inside the United States had gone back to virtual fascism. Because after the breaking of the wall in Normandy, when U.S.-led troops had broken into France, then the British knew the game was up. And they mobilized the people who had put Hitler into power initially, Americans, like the Harriman family, leading Democrats who played a part in putting Hitler into power in Germany, directly from here, including the grandfather of the present president of the United States, who was a fascist, the guy who wrote the letter to the German bank which financed the Nazi Party to stay in power, to come into power. Harriman, the great Democrat, another fascist. And these people came back into power over the corpse of Franklin Roosevelt. But they couldn't change everything, because what Roosevelt had evoked in my generation among the American people was a force which was not easily overcome, despite Truman, despite everything else, not easily overcome. They counted to have a generation pass and then they would make their big move. And so, beginning with the inauguration of a Kennedy, a real Kennedy, who was committed to the policies of Roosevelt and avowed this from the time he campaigned and throughout his period in office, John F. Kennedy. The world was faced with attempted coups against the peace. Adenauer in Germany was pushed out of government under British orders. De Gaulle was subjected to about 100 different assassination attacks organized by Britain and organized in part from the fascist base in Franco, Spain. Similarly, coups, deaths, everything happened. But even in that period, there was still strength. Then, John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And if you recall, some of you are old enough to recall this, recall the shock waves that went through the American population when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and it wasn't by some lone gunman, or three other guys, and others involved, to kill the President of the United States. What did it do? First of all, it shocked the people as 9/11 shocked the American people. It was a shock effect. Without 9/11, the Bush administration would have disintegrated in its early years. It was only 9/11 that enabled Bush to stay in power. And it was done for his benefit, not his personal benefit, but for the benefit of the presidency which he was going to assume nominal leadership of. Shocks of that type, of assassinations of presidents, the shock of killing of Bobby Kennedy was also crucial, like the killing of Martin Luther King was also crucial in shaping the cowardice which took over our population during the generation of the so-called baby boomers. This is what did a great deal to craft the attitudes of the baby boomers, why they're so impotent and useless today. They have never recovered from this effect of their young adulthood and childhood, late childhood. And so it was with Kennedy. The killing of John F. Kennedy made possible the Vietnam War, which would never have happened had he not been killed. He would have stopped it. He had the support of the advice of Douglas MacArthur, who was still alive then. He had the support and advice of Dwight Eisenhower, who was still very much alive then. It wouldn't have happened. And the Vietnam War was a fraud, just like the fraud which Tony Blair of Britain foisted on the United States, the Iraq War, the same kind of thing. And these things happened. Now, after the killing of Kennedy and the attritional effects of the war in Indochina and the 68er phenomenon, the United States, the Roosevelt-Franklin system, was essentially destroyed. And we began to destroy the economy. Now, the 68er phenomenon split the forces, the social forces, which had been the base of the Democratic Party, such that the 68ers, the youth, the young 68ers, were against Roosevelt. They were against industry. They were against nuclear power. And I'll come to that, significance of that a bit later. And therefore, the division of the Democratic Party, a blue collar against no collar, or blue collar against no shirt, this division corrupted the Democratic Party and enabled Nixon to become president. Now, Nixon was not important. That is, he was not a historical factor. He was a reflection of a historical factor, but he was not a historical factor. What Nixon administration did, which was controlled by certain outside forces, was the Nixon administration proceeded to destroy the United States. Now, there are three key steps in the destruction of the United States between 1969 and 1981. The first was July 15th, 1971. The fixed exchange rate system of the world was taken down. by Nixon, nominally, under the direction of a fascist who was known as George Shultz, who orchestrated this as part of a process. The second phase was once the U.S. dollar was no longer a Bretton Woods dollar, it was condemned to float on the international market. The second shoe was dropped under Nixon. And this is the reason why when the Saudis today pay $3 a barrel for crude loaded onto tankers in the Gulf, you pay $4 a gallon for gasoline in the United States. We don't have a U.S. dollar anymore. We have a euro dollar, which is controlled by the oil spot market based in Amsterdam. It's a part of the British system. There is an empire based on this use of petroleum as a controlling device to control the world economy. The United States dollar is not owned by the United States. It is controlled by this combination of the same thing as the BAE, the British BAE system. There is an empire which is not controlled by oil, but is pivoted on oil speculation, and which was launched with the great petroleum hoax, the oil shortage hoax of the 1970s. There was never a shortage of petroleum at that time. Tankers were kept away from ports or stuck in harbors moored off the coast at that time. There was more. The world was flooded with petroleum. We had an oil shortage. The effect of the oil shortage was to create the spot market. And under the spot market, the U.S. dollar became a creature of petroleum, of European petroleum, of Anglo-Dutch liberal petroleum. And the British enemy became openly the enemy of the United States. Not all at once, because they're worked from stabbing you in the back, not in the front. That's British methods, backstabbing, or getting somebody else to do it for them. They orchestrated politics. So as a result of that, we lost control of our own economy. And what did they do? Well, the second phase was the Brzezinski phase, the Carter administration. Now they had wrecked the U.S. dollar. They had wrecked the position of the United States in terms of world affairs. They had done that with a period, especially from the assassination of Kennedy through 1971 and the oil price crisis. Now what was the second move? The Trilateral Commission. Under Carter, under Brzezinski, and the whole crowd from Wall Street, this crowd, Council on Foreign Relations crowd, they put through a program, the Trilateral Commission program, which systematically destroyed the United States. It destroyed every element of the Franklin Roosevelt structure of the U.S. economy with massive deregulation. Not only the destruction, the purging and halting of nuclear power. Remember, with nuclear power, we would not have been prisoner to the spot market. And think of all the idiots that are against nuclear power. They don't intend to be traitors to the United States, but they are in fact. Because only the breaking the power of this oil monopoly in controlling the dollar on the world market could these things have happened. They destroyed our physical economy. They destroyed our farmers. They destroyed our farms. They destroyed our industries. They destroyed our protected mortgage-based security problem. They protected the right of people to have homes. They destroyed large parts of the banking system. They drove the prime interest rate up to above 20% under Carter. And they made a cultural change in the United States. No longer were we the world's leading agro-industrial power. No longer were we the leading power in technology. Suddenly we were half destroyed. Not fully destroyed, but half destroyed. And the measures which would have corrected this were prevented. We went into a recession, a deep one, in 1987, October of 87. That so-called recession was a depression. It was comparable in its immediate effects to what Hoover experienced. It was a Hoover depression. And what happened then? Alan Greenspan came in. And what did Alan Greenspan do? Well, Alan Greenspan used fake money. In other words, we had a system before, under Roosevelt, which was consistent with the American tradition from the time of Alexander Hamilton, and even earlier. Our system was based on a governmental control of our own currency, and a defense of that control, to give us a stable currency, and to give us an accountable one. What they did, by destroying the Bretton Woods system in the way they did, and going to a funny money system, and then going to a hyperinflationary system like that under Alan Greenspan, we now have obligations in the world in the order of magnitude of hundreds of quadrillions of dollars of normal claims. These claims will never be repaid. They could never be repaid. Right? Now, under the Alan Greenspan system, we destroyed the United States and destroyed the morals of people. You have whole parts of the labor force who don't know what work is. They may have jobs, but they don't know what actual productive work is. They couldn't farm. They're no good in industry. They have no skills, no knowledge. People graduating with scientific degrees from universities who don't know what science is, but they get a degree in it, even an advanced degree in it. Such is the nature of things. We have been destroyed. So what has happened is, looking from the death of Roosevelt to the present, we've gone through a process which the greatest power, economic power for good, which ever existed on this planet, has been virtually destroyed by foreign influences on its domestic behavior. Our problem is to get the American people to realize they have been screwed. But they did it to themselves. But under influence, they had advisors, like Booz Allen Hamilton or so forth. They were advisors. And that's how they were induced to screw themselves. They're told this is the smart thing to do. And they broke their back trying to screw themselves. So now the time has come. We're now at the end of the rope. Probably by April of this or May this year, it's as early as that, the decision on what's going to happen to the world as a whole will be decided. This is not merely inside the United States, it's also inside Europe. You have now a great conspiracy by the same people on both sides of the Atlantic, one destroying the United States with help of the election campaign orchestration now, the other in Europe by the introduction of what's called a new European system. It's called the Lisbon Treaty System. Wild-eyed globalization and pure fascism. The policy of the British, who created this agreement, the Lisbon Treaty Agreement, is fascism throughout Europe. Not only fascism, but war throughout the Eurasian continent. War against Russia. War against China. Destruction against Asia generally. That is the policy. It's British policy. And the complement is the British policy for the United States, which is expressed typically, only typically, by Felix Rohatyn. And Felix Rohatyn is a thorough fascist in the same sense that Adolf Hitler was a fascist and the same sense that Mussolini before Hitler was a fascist. And the folly, the stupidity of Americans in the Senate, in the House of Representatives, being controlled by Felix Rohatyn and others like them, this is stupidity beyond belief. You get the impression that there's not a single committee in the House of Representatives which is able, even those who want to, was able to get anything through which resembles a defense of U.S. interests. The Congress now is hopelessly corrupt under the influence of Pelosi, who's under the influence of Rohatyn, the fascist. And she either is a fascist herself or probably too dumb to be one, but she is at least intelligent enough to be his puppet. And the minute anybody tries to do anything useful in this Congress, she steps in on behalf of Felix Rohatyn to stamp it out. We, for example, beginning at the end of 2004, I was part of a leading part of a process to try to defend Social Security against the Bush administration. That policy was generally adopted during the early part of 2005 by the leadership of the Democratic Party, with whom I cooperated significantly in the Congress and elsewhere. We saved Social Security, but by about March to May of that same year, Felix Rahatan had stepped in to prevent the next step. What I had recognized is we were about to lose our automobile industry. So we would no longer have an American automobile industry. We might have a Japanese automobile industry inside the United States, but not a U.S. automobile industry. So through this operation that was run internationally, the automobile industry was destroyed. Yes, the management was somewhat stupid, but they were stupid under British influence. And under influence was radiated from Britain, under these stupid policies. We could have saved it. What I had proposed would have saved it. Simply by dividing the auto industry between producing autos on the one hand, which you could produce more than enough of, and on the other hand, taking the auto machine tool capability and its associated employees for large-scale infrastructure, federal infrastructure programs to rebuild our highways, not the highways so much, as our railway systems to modern railway systems, power systems, river systems, and so forth, things we needed. And employ the labor force and the management, which was the most skilled management in the world, formerly, to producing this new infrastructure under federal credit, which is the only way it would ever get built. You will never get any insignificant infrastructure program in the United States now under the present system. Only with a change in the system will you get it. Anybody says they're going to give you infrastructure, they're lying to you. And if you believe them, you're stupid. But that's Rahatan's program. Take your street. Put a poll tax on the street or something. And then collect taxes on it. You don't buy the street, you lease it. And the people pay to make the lessees happy. And the people are screwed. And some people call this an infrastructure program. It's a pocket-picking program. And when you're paying, you know, when you're traveling from, say, West Virginia to the Washington area as a daily commuting operation, you're traveling at least 2 hours each way in traffic. You're paying about $8 in tolls on the way and all these other things. And on top of this, this kind of life means that family life in the people who are living out there is ruined. If you're spending 4 hours a day in commuting, and you're paying more than you can afford, say up to $8 in toll, and $4 a gallon for gas, what's happened to your life? People are being screwed. Why has this happened? Well, we used to have a policy of balanced management. We used to say we would take the whole territory of the United States, which is something we began to do on a design made by John Quincy Adams when he was Secretary of State. When the idea of the unification of the United States between Atlantic and Pacific and Canadian and Mexican border was established as our policy, was to take this entire territory of the United States, so defined, and develop it in each part, and to settle it in each part, so that you lived in communities where you could get to work or to school within 15 minutes to a half an hour a day commuting. That was the idea. So you would have a distribution of places to work, which would provide opportunities for employment for all the members of the community. You would have the community specialize in things which were appropriately located in that area, with enough diversification so the community was not dependent upon any single industry. We were against giant corporations. We were for cooperation among more closely held, community-related, high technology industries, high technology agriculture, more locally controlled. Because in this way, by decentralizing much of production and life, you enable people to have a better life, more economically, and so forth. Now we have destroyed whole sections of the country, like Michigan, like Ohio, like whole sections of Pennsylvania, which was once the big industrial center of the United States. The western farmlands are essentially destroyed. Oh, they grow things there, but it's destroyed essentially. The water systems of the United States, the Oglala Aquifer system, is essentially destroyed. We are being destroyed totally, all by this system. And thus did Winston Churchill's heirs destroy the United States over this period. We who had represented the greatest power on this planet at the close of World War I, we who were prepared and committed to free the people of colonized nations, we were committed for justice, a system of sovereign nation states on this planet, an end of these managed imperialist wars, which is Roosevelt. We went from that, and we were corrupted step by step by step by step, as I have outlined this here today, until we're at the point now where as early as May of this year, the United States may be doomed. And most people don't have the knowledge or guts to do anything about it. Especially on the... What's the plan now? Well, the plan is they use Obama the way they use Giuliani in New York. Remember what happened to Giuliani, the mayor of New York? Maybe the stallion, I don't know. But they build him up as a presidential candidate. At the same time, they took his organized crime record, which was rather generously equipped, and they ran the two things together. Run him as a putative Republican presidential shoe-in, and then build up an organized crime story exposing what his activities are, and destroy him. They did the same thing with the Democratic Party. They came over, Hillary was the front runner. They took Obama, who was the next Giuliani, who was intended to be brought down by an organized crime scandal, coming out of Britain with a guy called Ouchie, who is the financial backing for a guy out in Chicago who's now on trial, Resco. And the British have orchestrated this. They built up Obama, and then they set into motion the trials and the scandals which are going to bring him down. And he was kept in there to destroy Hillary Clinton. The idea is the minute that Hillary Clinton was destroyed, presumably, by the Obama operation, then they would turn around and destroy Obama, which they're also doing. So they're still engaged in this game of trying to destroy both Hillary and Obama. And they prefer Obama because they could destroy him more easily than they could Hillary. Hillary is a front runner. It would be tougher to destroy. Obama is very vulnerable. They could destroy him very easily. It would have the additional benefit of discouraging the American population. If you build up a candidate as a populist candidate, as Obama's been built up, then you bring him down. You demoralize a whole section of the voting population. And we have the greatest participation in campaigns now we ever had in terms of the primary campaigns. You destroy the American people just when they think they're going to get something good. And you give them a promise, tease them with a promise. Sex all night, the Obama campaign. Then you take it away from them. You demoralize them. And then you can do something else with them. In the meantime, if you can use Obama to destroy Hillary, then you have no candidate except McCain. Now, McCain has some interesting pedigree in the fact that he comes from the Pacific-oriented naval tradition of the United States military. And to the extent that we're operating, that he listens to that influence, he's likely to do a number of good things, like junk the George Bush policies and so forth, because only a traitor could support George Bush. You'd have to be stupid or be a traitor, one of the two. And so therefore, that's interesting. But the point, the guy has problems. And therefore, he's vulnerable in various ways. So we are at a point where you would say, wait a minute. We don't have any presidential candidates that are going to survive. If Hillary goes, we don't have anything. Oh, they have something. The mayor of New York. Not the stallion, but the mayor. Bloomberg. Bloomberg is a pig. That's the kindest thing you can say about him. He is a complete fascist. He's controlled by people like Rohatyn, who is an absolute fascist, a Hitler-Mussolini-type fascist. All right, now what's this fascism thing then? Fascism is a medieval conception. It came into prominence as a system after the Fourth Crusade, when the looting of the remains of the Byzantine Empire had occurred. There was still Constantinople, which called itself the Byzantine Empire, but that didn't really exist. The Byzantine Empire was destroyed. It was destroyed by the Crusade, the Fourth Crusade, organized by the Venetian bankers. As a result of this, what they did is they set up a system where they based government not on a central government, but on a League of Cities. The League of Cities, which in the middle of the 14th century collapsed when one of the cities, the Lucca, the bank of that city, the Bardi Bank, went bankrupt on its loans to England and in France, certain countries in France. These bankers had been engaged in financing wars and backing operations which related to wars. They destroyed society. And the destruction that occurred, immediately triggered by the bankruptcy of the Bank of Bardi, the House of Bardi, resulted in a collapse of the European population by one-third in a short period of time, and resulted in the elimination of half of the parishes of Europe. This is the great dark age of that period. Now, what they're proposing now, as Bloomberg is a part of it, and all the people associated with him, all the people behind him, all the people behind Rohatyn, are associated with this, which is to set up elimination of the sovereign nation state as an institution and its replacement by a League of Cities, which means you take the entire territory of the countries involved, you just write off whole part of the area, and concentrate on cities or city areas which become governments of themselves and the area around them. They're not really governments because they're vulnerable. And you control them that way, as in the Middle Ages, as in what led into the great crash of the great dark ages of the 14th century. That is Bloomberg's policy. That is the policy of Rohatyn. He says so explicitly, but people don't understand it. They're not thinking clearly. Even leading politicians are not thinking clearly. What does this mean? Are we going to have to learn this after the fact, as people learn this after the fact in the case of the Middle Ages? Are we capable of seeing that this is now, this is coming now, that this is the end of civilization, if we allow it to happen? Now, this is not just happening in the United States. It is happening also in Europe. In Europe, the form of this action is called the Lisbon Treaty. Now, the Lisbon Treaty is a complicated mechanism. It is both fascism. It is the elimination of the sovereignty of every nation state, presidency, and parliament in Europe. They haven't gotten to Russia yet or Belarus, but they'll get there if they can. It aims to be a permanent war organization of a feudal type, where the power now resides in cities and in the financial organization, the bankers who control these city operations. The purpose is then to use the power of a united imperial Europe under British control to destroy Russia, to destroy China, etc., India, and so forth, and to destroy the world and to make the world malleable for the kind of things that Felix Rohatyn represents. Felix Rohatyn is an enemy of the United States. He's a traitor to the United States. He's an agent of the British monarchy, those British monarchy interests which are behind this operation, which are running the same operation in Britain under the name of the Lisbon Treaty Organization, which is not yet official, but it's threatened. And at the same time in the United States, it's called the Bloomberg Operation, which is run by not only Rohatyn, by George Shultz, et cetera, the known characters. Wherever you hear this idea of infrastructure, from that son of a Nazi, Schwarzenegger. The father was not only a Nazi, he was a killer. He was a police chief in a local region of Austria, who, when Anschluss occurred, that is the absorption of Austria into Germany occurred under Hitler, became immediately appointed to the Nazi Party official, and during the war became a part of a special police unit which cleaned up the occupied territories of Eastern Europe. Not the SS, but a special police force. It's the same mentality is expressed by Schwarzenegger himself in his public appearances. And therefore he comes by the fascist policy which he adopted in California in the embrace of Bloomberg as his father's masters, the Nazis. He is effectively a Nazi. He comes by it by heredity or culture. We have mayors who are stupid. We have governors who are stupid, who think that this is turning your infrastructure over to private financiers who then can set arbitrary prices on leases, that is, in fees that you have to pay to drive from one neighborhood to the next, or something similar, all public services taken over by private interests under citywide organizations in a national network, which is exactly what these guys have proposed. That is exactly what Bloomberg represents in New York City already. That's what he's trying to do. That's why he has so many enemies in the elected council. He's a fascist. This was called, when they put it into effect in Italy, it was called corporatism. Exactly this policy. This was the policy of Mussolini. When Schacht consolidated Hitler's power in Germany, the same operation was done. The same kind of operation. The intention was of the Nazi system for its post-war policy was the occupation of all Europe under this kind of policy, to elimination of the nation state for what was called universal fascism. So what we have then is we have the United States is being destroyed from inside by fools who don't recognize this threat to the United States, and by the instruction of people from London such as Tony Blair, who set this policy into motion when he was prime minister. This means the United States and Europe are both destroyed and are turned into vehicles for destroying other parts of the world, as in South America, Central America, Eastern Europe, Asia generally. That's the policy. Do you want it? I can guarantee you that I don't exaggerate in the least that that's what the policy is. And that's exactly what's in motion. That's exactly what's behind the way the Obama campaign is being orchestrated from London. London put Obama into his position. His money came to support him, came in large part from Britain, from Auchi, who's an Iraqi-born asset of the British system. Auchi is the funder of the guy who's on trial in Chicago now. The guy whose funding went, Resco didn't have the money. Auchi gave it to him. Auchi was the key seed money for this operation. That's what made Obama. That's why he behaves so peculiarly. He has no policy. He has no program. He says, I'm going to do everything, but he doesn't say anything. I'm going to make everything good. What is this good you're going to do? Well, that's not specified. He's a tool they intend to bring down. And if they get a lot of people to believe in him, they're going to bring them down too. Because the suckers will just be demoralized. They won't fight anymore. Their stuffings will be taken out of them. So that's the key question that faces us. Now, this is not necessary. If we go back to the Constitution, which very few people in the Congress understand today, or in the Supreme Court, either, for example. But if we go back to our constitutional foundations and look at the history of Europe in which these constitutional foundations were laid, that is, you know, European civilization was started somewhere between 700 and 600 BC. It was started actually by an alliance among the Etruscans together with the Egyptians, particularly in northern Africa, who are maritime the part of Egypt, and the Ionians. And this collaboration against Tyre by these three forces. That was the maritime power of these localities against the maritime power controlled by Tyre. And this created this unification process, out of which you had the emergence of a united kind of European civilization. That is, there is no such thing as a European people. There are many people who have, European historical characteristics biologically. But there's no such thing as European people. There's a European culture. And as we see in the United States, or as we see in some cases in Europe, or we see in Germany, for example, many Germans are not of German origin in terms of ethnic origin. They're a product of a cultural process into which their ancestors, they became assimilated, and they represent a certain cultural history which they share. As a matter of fact, the whole thing is composed of various cultural histories among various kinds of European cultures. And in order to have a representative form of government, you must have nations which are sovereign, which represent the culture of that people. Not globalization. Because you do not have representative government unless the people are fully consciously capable of recognizing their own interest in their own government. Therefore, you do not want globalization. You want sovereign government of a sovereign people which is governed by its culture. That these cultures agree on a common purpose for humanity. They don't make war because they have differences. They cooperate because they have differences. And that was the intention. The United States, as a melting pot nation, is a perfect example of this. We're a melting pot nation. And apart from some racists and other damn fools among us, we are that today. We don't care what the color of the skin is or anything else. It doesn't mean anything to us. Are they part of this culture? Are they a contribution to this culture? Are making this culture or building it? If so, they're part of our people. And that's our sovereign system of government. Better than Europe. Because we have a representative system in government here. We don't have that in Europe. We have parliamentary systems which come down easily anytime they get into conflict with the financial powers that be. But in our case, we have this. And this is what we should defend. But now, what's the solution then? The power of the United States, under Franklin Roosevelt, as exhibited earlier, is this specific cultural factor. Europeans did not come here as flight from poverty in Europe. Yeah, some of them may came, but the settlements themselves did not come that way. The settlements came as a result of Europeans knowing that as long as the oligarchy is running Europe, this place is no place to be. So therefore they said, we must go across the ocean to this territory which had been discovered and set up republics in this area where the ideas of European culture can be freely expressed without this damn oligarchy sitting on our necks. That was what the United States is. And therefore, we are a truly representative system of government, at least in our constitutional roots, with this intention to bring the best of European culture here, away from Europe, away from the oligarchy, away from the nobility, the aristocracy, away from the looters, away from the predatory bankers, and to be able to express the values of European culture in a land of opportunity for developing that expression. That has always been our secret power as a nation, whenever we've accomplished something. That we are part of European civilization and open with an affectionate feeling about other parts of world civilization and believe that we must cooperate with other nations by arguing and developing common interests for common purposes. And that we must liberate that process. Now, this is what Roosevelt intended to do. Roosevelt is not an accident. He's more American than any other president since. Because he understood this and practiced this. His intention was to eliminate all imperialism in the post-war period. To use the power of the United States to help nations which have been colonized to build up and become true nations expressing their own culture freely. And to bring these nations together as sovereign nations in a unit, which he intended by his proposal for the United Nations organization, to create a receptacle in which you could take nations and build nations up and bring them into an institution where they would become sovereign powers together with the other sovereign powers, and to eliminate all colonies, all empires from this planet forever. That was the purpose. And that was came from that the natural constitutional expression of what the intention of the United States existence is and was, always was, and should be now. So therefore, the remedy for anything which we do, required to do, must be from the United States, must be an expression of that historical view of who we are and what we are and what our constitutional structure means. That means that we, how do we intervene in this present situation? The whole, money is worthless. Money has no intrinsic value. What happened with the Carlyle Group and what it when the Carlyle Group's collapse triggered with other groups today is a new acceleration of the crisis. The system is coming down. We are not in a depression. We are in a general breakdown crisis. We are in a process of financial collapse, which is comparable in form to what happened in Europe in the 14th century when the general dark age hit. We are in the middle of an onrushing dark age. The nearest comparison to what's happening to us now inside the United States and worldwide is seen in Germany in 1923. Germany was isolated because it was under these conditions set by the Versailles Treaty Organization. It had no power and no ability to resist the United Nations forces. I mean, the Versailles Treaty forces. Therefore, it was compelled to inflate. And under these constrained conditions, it went through a form of hyperinflation which led to the collapse of the German mark in 1923, in October, November 1923. We are now going through a process of hyperinflation which is very much like that which occurred to Germany under confined condition, especially between 1921 and the end of 1923. That's where we are now. There's no way that we can manage the current a stimulus package. That's what they did in Germany. In 1923, especially, 21 through 23, but especially 23. The stimulus package coined a phrase, hyperinflation. What do we have now? We have a collapse of that nature. In this case, a collapse of the world system. We don't have some outside power that's controlling this as such. The world just cannot take this system anymore. So therefore, what happened on a localized situation in Germany in 1933 is now happening globally, but hitting primarily in Europe and the United States in the transatlantic powers. But if the transatlantic powers go under, China will go down, India will go down, everything will go down. The world will go down in the dark age. Now, therefore, money as defined by the Federal Reserve System is no good. No damn good. So what do you do? Well, we have under our Constitution the constitutional powers of the U.S. government, which are unique in the history of constitutional law. These are the constitutional powers which were used by Franklin Roosevelt to take the United States out of a deep depression and make it once again a great power, the greatest power the world had ever seen in terms of economic power. How did we do that? Well, we reformed the currency. We took measures of bankruptcy and similar kinds of measures. We got things moving again. And by the end of the war, we had created the greatest economic power the world had ever seen. With the American Constitution. Well, how can we do that again? All right, now the immediate thing, we don't have a housing crisis. We have a housing crisis in the sense that people may not have to find houses to live in, that they're allowed to live in. But we don't. The housing crisis, or the so-called subprime crisis, is merely the tail end of the real crisis. It's the weakest point in the system. It is not the source of the crisis. The source of the crisis begins at the highest level. It begins with the financial institutions. The bankruptcy is occurring in the leading financial institutions of the world. And every financial institution of the world, that is especially in Europe, transatlantic ones, immediately, are in the process of disintegrating. So the disintegration is coming from the top, but is reflected at the bottom. It's reflected in the impact on the weakest section of the people and the economy. So therefore, what do we do? we have to protect the household. We have to keep people in their homes and their communities. Number one. Well, we can do that. How? Well, the federal government has the authority, the power of bankruptcy. We bankrupt the system. And we put the homeowners under protection. And we negotiate an arrangement under which they will continue to be homeowners until we can sort this mess out. And then we'll sort it out with a final solution. But you can't save the homeowners if you don't save the banks. You have to save the local banks, not the filthy banks, but the local ones, the ones that are real banks that take deposits and loan money and are vehicles for the federal government and state governments to conduit funds through them for local purposes or state purposes, and thus you stimulate the growth of the economy. Now you put the banks into the business with federal help of building up again to make up for what they lost with all this foolishness. And now you have, without skipping a step, you have a continuity of the bank yesterday and today. No difference. On the outside, no difference. For the ordinary citizen, no difference. You go in, you make your deposits, you make withdrawals, it's your business. You get loans for your local business. You get loans for community purposes. But you also conduit federal credit created by the federal government, which you put through various programs, through the private banks of these types in order to rebuild the economy. You put people back to work, exactly the way Roosevelt did. Now, then you have to set up another system. Second thing, you have to set up a two-level system where you have one rate, 1% to 2% for loans. That's the federal rate. And for programs that are authorized, they will get through the banks, the local banks, or through the government directly, but preferably through the local banks. The federal program will then be authorized to conduit money of this type, federal-created credit, through the local banks, the state banks, and the national banks, in order to provide this credit for specified purposes for investments in the economy and for employment, whatever the federal government authorizes. And then, so now you've protected the banks by putting them into bankruptcy protection. You've protected the people. So you now have protected the local communities. And that's your base of operation. That's what Roosevelt allowed to do. The problem we have today is greater than Roosevelt faced, much more serious. But nonetheless, the same method will work. And it's the only method that will work. Then you have to have a program of a driver program, which is large projects. We need to free ourselves from this petroleum crisis. We need nuclear power. We have in the third and fourth generation, so-called, with certain types, like the pebble reactor types, we can produce power of greater power and cheaper than you can get with any other means. And there is no cheaper power available than nuclear power. That's a matter of physical principle, not some economist gibbering. But not only is that true, but the nuclear power, not merely in quality is better, but it's better in quality. Why? Because it enables you to go to the higher levels of physical principles. For example, with an 900 megawatt fission reactor of the pebble type, you can not only produce many things, but you can generate synthetic hydrogen-based fuels locally from water. And the waste of the consumption of this fuel is water. Not a bad investment. You create water, use water then for nuclear power or hydrogen-based fuel power. When the hydrogen-based the fuel is consumed, it gives you up back water. Not a bad deal. So we have, by going to high technology programs which shift the economy and its technology to a higher state, we can raise the level of productivity of nations and solve problems we can't solve under the system. The other thing we have to do, we have to break the world free of petroleum slavery. We still will use petroleum, but basically we should be shifting away from petroleum to using petroleum as a fuel, to using petroleum as a chemical feedstock for production. And there are many things that you can use petroleum for in that way. So then you would now, instead of having shipping oil as crude oil from Saudi Arabia into the ocean where it sits parked well, people bid it up to your $4 a gallon rate for gas. Instead of doing that, you take the petroleum where it's extracted and you set up a chemical industry, which is based on the use of petroleum as a feedstock for producing various kinds of things. Then when you ship something, that the value of what you ship is per pound worth much more as a product per pound than the petroleum. Therefore, the weight being about the same, the cost of production, the cost of shipping is now lowered. So therefore, it's a better way to run the economy. And by those kinds of measures, we can make it. What we have to essentially do is to have the world awakened to the reality of these alternatives. We have only two ways to go. The way I've indicated, a Roosevelt kind of orientation toward dealing with a general breakdown crisis, as I've indicated. The other way to go is to go to hell. There is no other way. There is no middle ground. There is no compromise. What we need is a revolt of the patriots. People who see what patriotism really means. It's not, I love my country. What are you going to do for your country? What are you going to do for the world? That's patriotism. Are you committed to some practical benefit for your nation and the world? Are you committed to some necessary action on behalf of the world and the nation? That's patriotism. The idea of acting in unity for a nation to accomplish something to that purpose is patriotism. What we have to create is a world system. And a world system of nation states, not a world system of globalization. We don't need the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel was a bad idea. We don't want it back again. It had a bad reputation in the Bible. That's a good reason. No more. So what we need is, therefore, is to have the United States do what it can do under its constitution, which other nations generally cannot do. They don't have the constitution to do it with. They don't have the tradition that goes with the constitution needed. We, as the United States, must go to certain principal nations of the world to create a nucleus of alliances of nations, which will do what? They will create a fixed exchange rate world monetary system, equivalent in that sense, in functional sense, to the Bretton Woods system as Roosevelt intended. And what we will do then, the United States, of course, has a constitutional power to utter money, which is a unique authority of the U.S. government. But other nations don't have that kind of system. But when we enter into agreements, treaty agreements, with China, with Russia, with India, and with other countries, we now can enter into what are called long-term trade agreements, trade and investment agreements, at low interest rates, 1 to 2% again. And by this means, we're looking at 20-year, 40-year, 100-year kinds of advances of credit, which is what we need now. Then you now have a basis for organizing, by revitalizing international trade, by introducing a new factor of vitalization of productivity in international trade, you now have a way of getting out of the present debt structure and similar kinds of things. So therefore, these purposes, which are fairly elementary in history to the historian, represent an understanding of the problem and a solution to the problem, if only as I've sketched it. This is what we must do. We must overcome the stupidity which seems to control the Congress, or most of the members of the Congress, and control many citizens who prefer to be ignorant because they like desperation better than solutions. In order to accept these three simple steps, one, HBPA, we must provide for an indefinite period until we can solve the problem, we must provide bankruptcy protection for the homeowner and for the banks. That is for the legitimate banks, for legitimate banking operations, not speculation. Secondly, we must establish a two-tier credit system between 1 and 2% for government-authorized credit, and let the credit float, interest rate float, to 7 or 8 or 9% for other things. No stimulation package. a stimulation package is called a hyperinflationary package. Anybody who is for stimulation, like these sex freaks like Paulson and Bernanke, they want stimulation all the time. Stimulation. Get them some Viagra, whatever. But don't give them money. And don't float money out there. You've got to have a conservative view to defeat inflation. You must have a regulated view, an expansive view, for construction, for the security of people, for the security of communities, and for the normal functioning of the country as it used to function. As these habits are built into our system, normal banking, no more of this hyperinflationary stuff, no more golden parachutes. 1 to 2% basic rate. Rebuild the economy. People can understand that. Secondly, have a system of credit which is anti-inflationary. 1 to 2% for authorized use of the federal government as a means of generating credit. And for distribution primarily, when not by the government itself, primarily through state and national chartered banks functioning in a normal way, pre-inflationary, pre-Volcker, pre-Greenspan ways. We need that. We also need a factor of world expansion and cooperation, which means we have to go to create a partnership among a number of leading powers, which include Russia, China, and India. China is one of the biggest markets for the United States, and we are one of the biggest markets for China. If China goes down, we're in trouble. Therefore, we have to worry about China. And China has to worry about itself, it has to worry about us, as it does. Chinese government now understands this is a problem. India may be not quite as quick on this one, but they'll pick up on it. They understand it too. If we bring together an alliance of the United States, Russia, China, and India, and bring other countries into the same alliance on economic policy, we can create a new international monetary financial system, like the Franklin Roosevelt system. Under those conditions, with these three measures, and measures which are required to facilitate their implementation, we can mobilize most of the world to get the hell out of this thing and come back to a system where we can, human beings can decently live again. Thank you.
Thank you, Len. Well, for those of you who are familiar with these proceedings, the way that we conduct the question and answer period is as follows. There are a certain number of questions that are being submitted as we speak by various institutions here in Washington and internationally. People who are listening to the webcast via the internet have the opportunity to submit questions via email. And for those of you who are gathered here in the audience, you may also ask questions. What I would ask you to do, if you have a question for Mr. LaRouche, is to identify yourself on an index card, which various members of the staff have available. I need you to just identify yourself. If you want me to ask your question, write it out. If you want to ask the question yourself, that's okay, but you have to indicate the nature of your question because we do try to group the questions with some coherence. Lynn, the first question actually comes from somebody who is associated with writing policy for one of the presidential campaigns. And the question is as follows. Mr. LaRouche, as you may be aware, Senator Clinton has refined her housing proposal to adopt policies that forcibly reduce the amounts of money owed by homeowners in the following ways. Number one, she wants to change the treatment of primary residences in bankruptcy proceedings. Number two, she has called for a blocking of any interest rate resets. Number three, the blocking of foreclosures for a specified period of time. Initially, she had said 90 days. She's extended that to 120 days. Four, she is calling for legislation of mortgage write-downs. And finally, to allow current homeowners to stay on as renters. My question to you is this. Can this be done without the establishment of a separate and new federal institution? It would seem very difficult for us to implement this within the framework of the current banking system.
Well, what she has proposed on these accounts is all friendly to what is needed. That's clear. But it won't work by itself. And therefore, what it omits is where the problem lies. You've got to realize, see, what's not mentioned in this thing is banks. You've got to realize, as the Carlyle collapse and what that is going to mean for other institutions. It means we're going through a new ratchet, an expanded ratchet of a hyperinflationary collapse of the U.S. economy and whole sectors and whole chunks of its institutions. Now, I don't think the loss of the Carlyle Group is a great loss in of itself. It is not an essential institution of government. But nonetheless, the losses of these institutions in a disorderly way is a threat, and therefore postponing certain questions for the sake of compromise is foolish. It's what politicians tend to do. They compromise, and they become compromised in the process of compromising altogether too much. Without my measure, it won't work. Otherwise, what is the intent, obvious intent, the specific intent of her other proposals is a friendly one. I have no difference with those objectives, but it's not enough. And not enough is failure. We must, on the one hand, we must have blanket protection of the householder from being evicted. We must keep people in their homes. There may be exceptions here and there, but let's forget the exceptions for the moment. Let's look at the main job that we have to do. Because if you collapse the industry, you collapse whole communities. Now, the other side, if you don't protect the banks, well, it's not worthless. You shut down the communities. Without the banking institutions in the communities, you're going to shut down the entire communities. They can't produce. You have to protect the banks. As long as they're engaged in legitimate banking business, pre-Volcker and pre-Greenspan especially. So therefore, you have to have bankruptcy protection for the banker at the same time and in the same way that you have banker protection for the householder. Therefore, now you have stabilized the community. You don't put a time limit on. What she says is fine, in a sense. Well, let's see if we can do it in 120 days. Well, it won't be enough, I'm telling you. You'll never make it. You're talking about years. And look back at some of the experiences we had with Roosevelt in the 1930s. Look, when I was in consulting back in the 1950s and 1960s, I was running into cases of banks which were there just then cleaning up some of their banking problems from the 1930s. So that was long term. So therefore, you have to have a flexible view which is based on keeping the economy functioning. Keeping it functioning structurally in all essential features. And whatever it takes, however long it takes, you're going to do it. As you don't like to fight long wars, but sometimes you have to fight one, and sometimes on certain fronts, and this may be one of them. So that's that. Now, without these measures, now as to finally, the Federal Reserve System is bankrupt. Now, they don't like to say that, but it is. The Greenspan Federal Reserve System is hopelessly bankrupt. Now, what do we do about that? Well, the Federal Reserve System is a corporation created by the government. It is not a part of government. It is a corporation created by government. It's not a constitutional institution. And it shouldn't be. It's simply a vehicle, a private interest, a private organization, created by the federal government by acts, various acts, called the Federal Reserve Acts, which are sometimes sexual acts. And this thing is bankrupt. What do? We put the Federal Reserve System into bankruptcy, and the government runs it. So there is no conflict. When the slave is working for the master, there's no conflict. And the Federal Reserve System has to become the slave of the federal government. It is the implicit law of our Constitution. The federal currency is the property of the government. It's created by the consent of the House of Representatives and created by the federal government. The President of the United States is the President of the banking system. But the Secretary of the Treasury actually carries out the function. And the House Banking Commission, not with the present incumbent leader in it, but the House Banking Commission, then is responsible for sponsoring legislation to assist in defining the programs and purposes of utterance of currency. That's all we have to do. But you have to have the guts. You see, the problem here is trying to do a reform of the type that is required cannot be done sneakily. You know, don't try to do some little sneaky thing which you think will do something good. You have to tell the American people what you're doing, what the reform is, why it is, and what how it's going to work, and what their role in it, and where they go and what they do about this thing. You have to get the participation of the population with consent in participation in this policy. Therefore, putting the Federal Reserve System where it belongs into bankruptcy, receiving control of the federal government under the Treasury Department is what's required, along with the other measures. But you cannot take halfway measures in a case like this. The whole system is coming down. You cannot reform part of a broken down car. You have to reform the whole thing.
Lynn, the next question comes from a Democratic member of the Senate who has close ties and historic ties, actually, to the military. His question is, Mr. LaRouche, I don't know if you're aware of it, but today Vice President Cheney has taken the occasion of the 25-year anniversary of the SDI to call for an anti-missile defense system. You are repeatedly identified as the intellectual author of the SDI. Is it the case that Cheney has finally come around to your point of view? Or has your advocacy of an SDI changed?
Brother Cheney has come around to the point of my spear. What he proposes has nothing to do with SDI. And he's a liar. He lies all the time. Don't be surprised he does it once again. He's also a degenerate. And he gets most of his degeneracy from his wife, who's the expert. Oh, she's the boss. He's the ugly dog out tethered on the front lawn. She owns him. She's a member of British intelligence assets. He's actually a British agent. In a sense, he's a tentative, you could call him in principle, a traitor to the United States. And I think he's an agent of Blair, has been most of the time. But anyway, the SDI was a proposal concocted by me, devised between 1977 and 1979. It was a key feature of my presidential election campaign, my nomination campaign at that time. When Reagan was elected, I had met him briefly at one event before then in New Hampshire, and we had some fun together by remote control and otherwise on certain things. See, he belongs to my generation, and when we got into people like George Bush Sr., we said, well, this clown. And I think President Reagan always knew that George H.W. Bush was a clown. He's not as psychotic as his son is, but he was a clown nonetheless. He's not a very serious thinker. So what happened was, as I, at that time, it was stated later in a famous trial testimony of a member of the National Security Council at that time, of an earlier time, that what I did is I ran an operation, which I was, something came through the intelligence community to me, certain questions on how to try to deal with the Soviet relations. So I responded to this on the assumption that I was simply delivering a recommendation to those people in the intelligence community as to what I thought they should do with the Soviet Union. They came back to me and said, well, will you undertake doing this probe? And I said, yes. So I was sort of sworn in and became something doing that. Then when Reagan became president, my function in doing this was taken over under the supervision of the National Security Council, the head of the council. And so I ran an operation from that period, especially in 1982 through 1983, on behalf of the Reagan administration. And what was the president proposed on March 23rd of 1983 was exactly what I had proposed. He was a sense what he was doing, and the reason he did it that way, he was confirming to the Soviet government publicly what I had told the Soviet government through the back channel organization that I was doing for the U.S. government at that time. And that was the SDI. The purpose was, as in my address in October 12, 1988, in Berlin, where I forecast the immediate collapse of the Comecon sector, beginning with Poland, as for the immediate future, and what I recommended for U.S. dealing with the Soviet Union under a chain reaction collapse of the type I had anticipated, which happened. So the purpose of this was never a system for fighting war. It was a system for preventing war. And what you do is sometimes you get a situation where you have an adversarial relationship between states and history. And you don't want a war. Well, you can't settle the peace questions and everything all at once. You sometimes have to take concrete steps toward coming to cooperation on certain secondary things, which will lead toward cooperation on more fundamental things, by experience. Sometimes it's called building trust. Sometimes I would call it building new habits. Now, our point was, we had this thing started, was with the advent of the Carter administration, whose policies I denounced before Carter was elected, as leading toward a threatened thermonuclear confrontation, accelerating the threat. My view was, let's get this under control, because the thermonuclear weapons are not the infallible weapons of all future. They have a certain power now, as long as you give them that power. But we have technologies we could develop, or which we have the technologies to develop, by which we could outclass significantly any ballistic missile attack. We're not at that time, and we're not now, able to eliminate all missiles, attacking missiles. But we could ensure the survival of a nation under an attack, which would mean that this would mean just another big problem nobody would want. So the idea you cannot have an immediate complete victory by a preventive or preemptive thermonuclear attack was the objective we were working against. And the idea was we would work with two purposes. One, to take these technologies, which we knew from a scientific standpoint existed, and to develop them. Number two, to use this vehicle as a way of promoting technologies which would increase the productive powers of labor in each of these countries. And I was involved in a number of technologies to develop for this purpose. And the idea was that if the Soviet Union would cooperate with us in giving us what they knew of certain technologies or were doing, we would share that with them. We would jointly develop things that neither of us could develop alone. And by this, we would create a system to outflank the threat. Because once we enter into cooperation and get away from this ultimatistic confrontation, we have a chance of negotiating something out of this. See, the idea of war being fought permanently for the annihilation of some designated enemy is the greatest piece of stupidity you can imagine. You have to live on this planet with other people. You can never declare a war of annihilation or virtual annihilation against another people or nation. That is not moral, and it will not work. It'll backfire. You must find a way of bringing about cooperation among nations and making it more attractive than killing each other. You have to do that sometimes with the willingness to defend yourself in the process of trying to effect that result. But you're looking for peace, not for war. If you fight war, it's to try to preserve the possibility of peace. It is not to perpetuate war. Now, Reagan, in a sense, with all his fluctuations, up to the time of 1986, agreed with that, and probably agreed with that beyond that time. Gorbachev hated my guts on this question. And I had a lot of problems with Gorbachev, and still do, who still hates my guts on this issue. But that was the issue. So there's nothing in Cheney, for whom I have absolute contempt. He's just an evil thug. He's not really a human being in any functional sense. And he's trying to get us into another war, again. An Iran war, right now. That's what the Admiral Fallon resignation imports. So therefore, there's no connection, no similarity whatsoever between me and Cheney. Cheney, I would like to lock him up with his wife and let the two make each other suffer.
I think the good senator knew that he wanted you to go on record. Before I ask the next question, someone has submitted a quote that they thought might be fitting for today's situation. And it's a quote by John Milton. And since before I became the world's leading expert on bedwetting, I actually did my thesis on John Milton, I thought I'd read it. The quote is, "You, therefore, who wish to remain free, either instantly be wise, or as soon as possible, cease to be fools. If you think slavery an intolerable evil, then learn obedience to right reason and the rule of yourselves." So whoever dug that up, I think, did a good job. Okay, the next question comes from a group over at the Hamilton Group who apparently is listening to the webcast. And they say, "Mr. LaRouche, as you speak, we are grappling with the issue of economic stimulus versus fiscal stimulus. In this context, could you please address the question of a strong dollar? How would you defend the dollar in this framework?"
Well, I would defend it by the means I've already indicated, but there's some other specific things we do. For example, we do need some real infrastructure. You won't get it from that trader. You'll get it from me, and you'll get it from other people who agree with me. We do need to replace the automobile, our dependency on it, and our dependency on heavy trucks, on highways they destroy, by mass transit, which is largely improved forms of rail or magnetic levitation. We do need large-scale operations of freshwater. We do need an operation to rebuild the Oglala Aquifer, which I've been pushing for some years. We do need a massive program of high energy flux density production of power and its application through nuclear power. We need that now. We need other things. For example, we do need a new healthcare system. The present one is a mass murderous, evil system. And most people know it who have to deal with health care. This means institutions have to be rebuilt, means other things of that sort. We have to have a federal system of guaranteed health care production, not this collection of thieving, which is called private health care programs. And we can have private health care, but it has to be protected by the federal government so that everybody is guaranteed access to health care. And keep it simple. Don't make it complicated. Keep it simple, with good administrators working within the institutions who will constantly improve to make the thing work. Flexible. No more of these long-term contracts, which are largely fraudulent because they get reinterpreted anyway. So anyway, the main thing is these kinds of things in the social. I could also talk about education. Our education system stinks. We never have had such a bad educational system probably in U.S. history. We have teaching at people, not actually the development of the mental powers. We're running with a youth group. We're running an expanding program of fundamental science research. And I'm telling you that what our people are doing, they're doing work on the graduate level, which is superior to what's being taught in universities today. We have some cases of that, in case of a scandal involving NASA. Our work on Kepler was good, sound. As a matter of fact, it contained work that had never been done before in that way. The best educational program in that ever existed. And they put some guys up at Harvard, produced an attempt to fraudulently copy that, and failed. They produced a piece of crap. They could not do the calculations, and therefore what they did is they took our work and they, by pencil drawing, tried to copy our findings on how this worked. And in the end, they had no understanding of what Kepler discovered. They don't know what gravitation is. They write a whole book about this thing, apparently, which is fraudulent, and it's about the principle of gravitation and how it works. And we laid everything out there about as well as anybody could, and they don't even know what gravitation is. So that's typical of what goes on in educational institutions today. We do have to think about educating not on performance. We're not training seals to perform and bark in a certain way. We're trying to develop human beings who will have independent capability of creative thinking. We want to stimulate that creativity. We don't want to program them. We want to eliminate programmed learning and anything like that. We want to eliminate achievement scores, education, based on that. So there are plenty of things that are needed. Mass transportation, healthcare, water management, power development. These are the primary drivers of an economy. These are areas in which you can generate rapidly. For example, we want to recapture as soon as possible the lost engineering potential of the automobile industry. We want to get these guys back to work. We want to use these cadres as a way of assembling people for large-scale construction types of work, like building railway systems, building canal systems, building water management systems in general, building power systems. And these guys could do it. We could have done it in 2006. Take this whole chunk of the auto industry we shut down. And instead of throwing it away, employ the same people in the same places to do contracts on this kind of work. And they could have done it. They did it in World War II. That's how we won World War II. Just put these guys back to doing that kind of work. And we have to recapture the skills we have as rapidly as possible for high technology, capital intensive results in infrastructure. And that will be a driver. And it will work just the way Franklin Roosevelt's program worked. Be different program, same thing, same purpose.
Hey, a number of people who are supporters of Barack Obama have submitted very upset questions, and in some cases not questions but comments, which I will not read. But just to let you know, I got the message. There is, though, a question that was submitted by a member of the Black Congressional Caucus who says, Mr. LaRouche, do you actually believe that Barack Obama is a fascist? Or is he just being used? Isn't it possible that he's smarter than those who think they're using him and that he's really using them?
Unfortunately, he's not smarter. I don't think he's a fascist. I think he's a bit of a dummy. He's a guy who has his own particular slick way of getting along in life, but he has not made one single substantive proposal on program in a nation which is breaking down. Not a single substantive proposal that's a workable proposal. Now, Hillary has. I don't think she's done enough. I don't think anybody's done enough. But the point was, Obama is being used. He was being built up by people I know who built him up. they deployed him. And they planned to destroy him. They're using him like a piece of toilet paper. Attracted to the man sitting there who's in desperation and need of some service. Then they plan to flush him after that. That's the fact of it. And these guys have got to realize that. Obama is a fake, not because he is the concoctor of evil, but because he's being used. And he hasn't got the damned idea at all about what's happening to him. Every sign is he's completely confused. He knows something is going wrong. He has no idea what it is because he refuses to realize that what he's running is a nothing campaign. He could not qualify as president of the United States in performance. He's done nothing to establish any indication that he has competence in that. He has not mentioned one single step of program which would actually work, which is relevant to what the people of the United States need. That's a lousy... He's saying, wait for me. I'm the miracle man, Superman. He's got flying in. And I'll do miracles. I'm the man of Krypton. This is a great sucker game. And if you look at the history of the United States, the political history of the United States, this is typical of the butter and eggs campaign in the time of the Depression. This is a Ponzi scheme. Similar kinds of schemes. The guy has not got a single conception of how the U.S. economy works. He has a sophist conception of what law is. By using law in a way which everybody can interpret the words, but nobody agrees on the meaning.
Lynn, this particular question comes from someone who holds statewide office in New York, but it's similar to a number of questions that have come in. So Mr. LaRouche, could you please comment on the targeting of New York Governor Eliot Spitzer?
I think, as I know politics and I know people and I know business, I don't think that there are many politicians in this country who achieve relatively high office who aren't keeping herds of pigs in their closets. I don't think that organized crime allows anybody to become their boy without getting to commit something they can use against them when they want to in the future. That's the way it works. I don't think that people trust anybody. Some people don't trust anybody to promote them unless they've got something on them beforehand to control them, to threaten them. I would say check everybody's closet. Now, when you look at it that way, as I look at it, because I have some experience with these matters. I've experienced some very nasty frauds and know how they're structured when the Federal Department of Justice and others create them in the name of justice. But when you look at that and say, no, why would they come up with something out of the hell box at this time and to what end? Well, he had just confirmed an endorsement of Hillary Clinton, which he had made, in a sense, earlier, but he'd been pressured to withdraw that and change it. And when he refused to, a couple of days later, boom, what happened? Gee whiz. They had something on him in the hell box. And they brought it forward and said, get. And the next guy who refuses to take our orders better learn the lesson. You should ask who's the next target. I don't think Spitzer has any particular claim on anything of that sort. I think the number of sex freaks in the Congress probably vastly outnumbers. I mean, this is not real. When people fall for this thing, say, okay, when did these guys know about this? They got this woman in the closet, huh? They got a number for her, huh? number something or other. How long have they had that number? Was it somebody in the Department of Justice? Huh? Of the Bush Department of Justice? Was it somebody else? Why long did they have this? Why did they rush to get this into the press now? Why didn't they report it when they had the information? Why did they wait? So therefore, maybe the people you ought to convict are the people who sprang this scandal. Not that I recommend that doing that kind of thing. It's not a nice thing to do, particularly if you're on the public till, because it impinges on your reputation. But I know politics. I don't know how many other politicians in this country could escape some similar kind of problem. And why? Because that's the system. Not only organized crime, but intelligence services and others, as I know firsthand, before they promote somebody, they make them trustworthy by compiling evidence which could hang them any time they get out of line. That's the way politics works. So I would say, let's open all the closets. Say, if you've got something you think you ought to confess, confess now. Let's all get out there and have this confessional. It's a good old-time revival meeting. Let's everybody confess. Let's have an official agency to register confessions. So therefore, when you get a scandal like this, you can assess the situation based on what's going on in society. But what I know, this society is immensely corrupt. And people in power are the most likely targets to be entrapped into something which could be interpreted as corruption. We don't have a kind of system that's an honest system. And that we have to think about things that way. And the first thing I would say is, I want an inquiry. Okay, Spitzer was called forward. I want to know, on what date did you have this information? Who'd you get it from? And on what date? Then ask him. Okay, you passed this information on? Yes. How when did you have it? Or why did you call come forward now, at this particular moment, when he had just confirmed an endorsement of Hillary Clinton? You got other Times and all these people out there saying, oh, he's a terrible man, terrible man. I don't think he's a terrible man. I think he's a typical politician. There are very few exceptions to that, I tell you.
Okay, another question from someone associated with a presidential campaign. Mr. LaRouche, on the threat of fascism, you've identified corporativism as the framework by which modern fascism was first introduced in Europe by Mussolini. In its early stages, it seems that this was a seductive idea, so much so that history books report that even FDR flirted with it. And on the face of it, for many today, the policies that are being proposed seem reasonable. I know you addressed this in the main body of your remarks, but could you please talk a little bit more about what specifically corporativism is and how it differs from what we know as the American system? Because I am well aware of the fact that many of my well-meaning colleagues are being sucked into what are essentially corporativist models.
Well, first of all, let's take the case of Ed Rundell in Pennsylvania, governor. I don't think Ed Rundell has the brains to know what's happening to him, frankly. I don't think he's a stupid person, but I think on economics and politics, this guy is really not very much there. I don't think Schwarzenegger or Schwarzenegger or whatever really has any intelligence. He knows he's coming, but that's all. But Mayor Bloomberg, on his own performance and record, is one of the most massive pieces of corruption I know of today, as any individual. The guy challenged, well, you have $11 billion. No, I have $40 billion. Nobody in this world or this world has earned $40 billion in their lifetime. It's impossible. And I want to know what this great achievement is. What did he do? He invent God or something? So the point is, a lot of these guys are dummies, and they wish to be dummies. You know, the American people have become, especially the age group between about 50 to 65, active age group, of the white collar variety, have become sophists in the sense of the ancient Greece under Pericles that went down to hell in the Peloponnesian War. They're stupid. Why are they stupid? Because they're opportunist. They don't think about the truth. They think about their appearance. They're baby boomers. They think about getting ahead. They're the people who spit upon or rejected the blue-collar worker, rejected the farmer, or rejected science, physical science. They rejected nuclear power. They rejected technologies which are necessary. And they said, well, you got to be practical. We got to be practical. Look, people need jobs, right? Well, this will give some people some jobs. Doing what? Collecting fees on property which was created by the government, federal, state, or local, which is now leased to some corporate shark, who is given the power to set any rate they wish to on the tariff of the price of walking down that street that the government created. Now, anyone who doesn't understand that is not qualified to govern. Or if they're going to be qualified, you have to take them back to a school quickly and teach them how to govern. They don't know what they're doing. So what they do is, see, what we've gone from science to sociology. And very bad sociology at that. You're looking for consent. You are a nation of sophists. Our politicians are elected for their powers of sophistry, or to perceive what the current sophistry is. They don't really think about reality. They don't think about this. I mean, they don't think about what it is to take a highway which is built by the public funds, which people have to travel to get to and from work, to do their job. Now you put a tariff on there, you put a toll gate at either end of this section of highway, and you collect the toll. What the hell have you done? What have you invested in? You've invested in creating a toll gate. And maybe you will make a few repairs from time to time along the way. But the basic thing there, you're in to make a profit. That is, and a profit is what you didn't earn in these cases. So people say, yeah, but that gives jobs. But it robs jobs. It robs the lives of people. And the problem is that as long as people get the idea that of this fragmented Cartesian way of thinking, and don't think of the consequences, don't look for the global consequences of the decision they're supporting, and don't see the real consequences, just say, well, this would be good, wouldn't it? How can you argue against that? It'll do some good, wouldn't it? But the policy will destroy the country. Well, I'm just a practical man. Don't ask me about that. I don't know about the good of the country. I do know this will do some good. Idiot. And if you elect such people, you deserve what you get.
Okay, Lynn, I'm going to start kind of grouping questions together because we're getting a lot of questions especially from institutions that are very similar. We've gotten several questions on the subject of Roehatten, FDR, and John Maynard Keynes. Let's put it this way. Felix Roehatten openly refers to himself as a follower of John Maynard Keynes. He recently tried to reverse his previous public hostility to FDR by saying that he supported the New Deal. However, there are obviously issues at hand here. One cannot have it both ways. But there are many ill-informed, or in some cases lying, authorities who would insist that FDR and his Bretton Woods system were essentially Keynesian. Could you please address this?
That's because people don't know the history. And there are some people in Europe who, of course, came into adult life after World War II who don't know their history on this thing, who even people I respect as economists otherwise. What happened is Roosevelt convened the Bretton Woods session under his authority in 1944. In the course of the proceedings, John Maynard Keynes, a leading British economist, who had also endorsed fascism in 1938 in a book he wrote, the first edition of his General Theory. And so Keynes made a proposal. Now, Roosevelt had not intended what Keynes meant. Roosevelt himself had not supported Keynes. Roosevelt was explicit during the war that when the war is over, Winston, speaking to Churchill, the British Empire is going to end. Now, Keynes's system is based on the British Empire in terms of system. Keynes was a fascist. That was his background. As he said in the German edition, which was the first edition of his general theory, published in 1938 in Berlin. It said he preferred to have his book published in Germany at that time because it would have a better reception and be more applicable in Nazi Germany than it would be in a democratic country. And he was right. But what happened is this, is that when Roosevelt died, Truman came in, and Truman was a pig. Now, the crucial issue was this. Roosevelt's policy was, Winston, when this war ends, we're not going to have a British Empire. We're going to free these people, and we're going to help them develop and have their own independent governments. And Roosevelt had some very specific proposals he made, as at Morocco, on this particular question. But all through the war is that. Now, I come out of this tradition by various channels of the pro-Roosevelt period who, like General Donovan, the head of OSS, and others, were devoted to this intention of a post-war period as Roosevelt defined it. And when Roosevelt was dying while in office shortly after his installation, fourth inauguration, Donovan went into the office to meet with the president and came out gray-faced, saying to a friend of mine who was with him at the time, it's over. It's over. Which meant that Roosevelt's program for the post-war period, which had been the central driving force of all the real patriots of the United States who understood this at that time, was ended, and the British were taking over. What happened is that Truman adopted the British policy of not of encouraging liberation of the colonies, but of reestablishing colonialism. And that's exactly what Truman did. Now, under these conditions, the intention of the formation of the United Nations and the intention of the Bretton Woods system was subverted because the intention had been to free colonial nations by large-scale infrastructural projects and other things of development of these nations, and to protect them while they emerge from colonial status into sovereign nation-state pride. Right. Once that was done, remember the policy was, at the end of the war, Roosevelt's intention was to convert the greatest economic machine ever developed, for war, and convert that into a large-scale infrastructure and development program for the included purpose of freeing colonized nations and peoples for independent nation-state status. Under these conditions, therefore, the purpose of the Bretton Woods system was subverted under Truman. No longer was it freedom, but if you recall from the period, or at least from studying the period, most of you are younger, you will remember all the pro-colonial wars which the United States supported, as in Indochina, as in Indonesia, and elsewhere, as in Africa, where they ran a dirty policy, which is still running today. The U.S. policy toward Africa stinks. It's murderous, deliberately so. Under Nixon, it got worse. is colonialist. So therefore, the purpose, Roosevelt's purpose for the Bretton Woods system was not carried out. Under these conditions, where the British were taking more and more of a controlling role over the Anglo-American policy in the post-war period, the policies tended to go in the direction of Keynes's speech in 1944. So Roosevelt's intention was not Keynesian, but the British intention and Truman's intention was. And that's what we've inherited. Have we done anything, really done anything, to eliminate colonialism except to find neocolonialism? What's our policy toward Africa? What's our alignment when we come up against the British on the question of Africa? What's the policy of the United States respecting British policy toward Zimbabwe, for example, or other nations? What is the policy of the United States with respect to what happened at the Lisbon Conference on the question of Africa? The United States is the enemy of black Africa. The United States is the enemy of anti-colonialism, because we believe in the free trade, free market system, free to steal, and free to trade in people, free to trade in governments. What do we say? What's the standard for government? We don't approve of you because the British don't like you. We don't approve of your government because it doesn't support our policies. This is our problem. So that's what really is involved in the Keynes issue. Keynes' policy was based on a feature of the British, of central banking, in which he explained generally in all his works on this. There's no mystery. He's a central banker. And a central banking system which is opposite in purpose and effect to what the Federal Reserve System was conceived to be, even, or what, and certainly what the U.S. Constitution conceived to be as an economic policy. So that's the issue.
After this question, I'm going to start mixing up some of the institutional questions with some questions from people who are here in our live audience. So if you have questions, this is the time to identify yourself. Lynn, the next question comes from someone from Zimbabwe. Before I ask this question, though, I'd like to extend greetings to groups that are gathered on the continent in both South Africa and Tanzania who are listening to this webcast. This question, as I said, is from someone from Zambia who's not in from Zimbabwe, who's not in Zimbabwe at this time. The question is, she says, "Dear sir, I write to you as a Zimbabwean living abroad who, due to circumstances beyond my control, will be unable to take part in the upcoming presidential elections in my country, which I would otherwise do. I would greatly appreciate your view on the current situation in Zimbabwe and the upcoming elections within the international political and economic sphere. I would also appreciate your views with regard to Africa as a whole and how the current perilous state of the world political and economic system will impact my already extremely vulnerable continent."
Well, first of all, you've got to get a change in the world system, otherwise nothing you propose would work. Nothing you'd want to propose would work. The problem of Africa is, or take sub-Saharan Africa as a specific, but it's not limited there. But take sub-Saharan Africa as such. What's the problem? Well, on the best side, the African population, indigenous African population, has a very large component of relatively skilled agricultural workers, farmers, and so forth. The problem is that because we're working in a country which is largely a tropical or semi-tropical region, that if you grow crops, you have to protect them, because the things that will destroy those crops are running very wildly around these areas. So therefore, first of all, you have to protect the crop. You have to develop the crop, that protect the seeds, protect the conditions under which the crop is grown. You also have to protect the crop when it's growing. You have to protect the crop when it's harvested, because the bugs and other things will get it. You have to transport the thing so it doesn't rot in the course of transportation. what happens is a great amount, Africa has the largest single agricultural area of any continent virtually, but very small portion of its growth potential, product potential, actually is delivered to be consumed by Africans or others. And then when you take what is shipped out of Africa, like, you know, British-run Zimbabwe, is run still as Northern Rhodesia, in which English and related farmers are given all kinds of protection to grow crops which are shipped to feed the people in London. The useless parasites in London, why do they feed them? And the African farmer in Zimbabwe is prevented from those access to those measures which are necessary to make the African farmer in Zimbabwe comparable in terms of what he can do, because he can do it too, in there. So the basic problem then comes down to technology, and technology and infrastructure. Well, first of all, you need communities in the agricultural areas which are going to supply the technology to the farmers. We used to do with the agricultural extension programs in the United States. You're going to have to do things about developing special treatment for the specific conditions of Africa to protect the growing crops. You have to protect the harvested crops. You have to have stations in which you can package, say, grains. Package it in such a way that you use radioactivity as a way of neutralizing the diseases which get into a crop. Now you can get increased by that measure. You can increase the amount of food net produced for consumption in Africa. To do this means you've got to develop a high-speed railway system, a network that works. You've got to improve waterworks. You've got to control the pollution of various kinds of the stream. These are streams that are full of all kinds of very active and aggressive forms of life. And therefore, you have to protect it. So the basic thing is Africa needs the infrastructure needed, basically, to enable it to produce enough food for its own people. The policy of the United States since the 1970s has been, the middle of the 1970s has been, don't let it happen. Because, they say, the natural materials of Africa belong to us. If the present population of Africa is already consuming too much of those raw materials which we want to save for the future for us. Besides, the population is already too large. We have to reduce it. How? Why, natural methods. Natural methods. Disruption. Wars. Other means. It needs power. The ideal power for Africa is basically nuclear power. South Africa, if supported, has some nuclear reactors and nuclear reactor program, which is quite adequate for much of Africa. This is needed for Africa. It gives you the cheap power and the capability, flexibility for doing many things. So therefore, if we wished to help the African, we could do it. The programs exist. But it is specifically those measures which will be needed to meet the needs of the African, which are prohibited under present U.S. policy. Taking the orders, the U.S. taking its orders, from the British Empire, better called the Brutish Empire.
Yeah, I said I was going to start mixing things up, and I am, because I need time to organize all these questions. From the audience here, John Asher had a question. John, you want to come to the microphone?
Yes, Lynn, your discussion about the petrodollars and the eurodollar reminded me of the, brought up the question to me of the transition in the period of getting a new Bretton Woods, which is that when Roosevelt, when he first came to power, he had to deal with the collapse of the gold standard, the fact that the dollar was under massive attack. He took steps, actually went really to war against the speculators. And I'm just wondering from the standpoint, what's going to have to be the transition here out away from this euro-dollar, petrodollar system in terms of bringing in, you know, the HBPA, a new Bretton Woods, what we're going to do about this you know, monstrosity that exists around the planet in terms of these dollars sloshing around. I'm, and I remember one thing you'd said years ago about the All the drug money out there and what would be done to kind of force people to account for a lot of those dollars. So I'm curious if there's anything beyond the two-tier proposal and the other things you've outlined that are going to have to be done in kind of the transitional period.
Okay. Well, you see, John, I used to be a consultant, and I lived in an environment of consultants and was involved not only with the things I was involved in directly, but involved in looking at what other people in consulting were up against. And naturally, if you're a consultant, you tend to be called in when you're dealing with a potential bankruptcy or an actual bankruptcy. So one of my best experiences, most enlightening experiences have been outside of technology, have been how to deal with bankruptcies. And very few people have the trained guts to deal with an actual bankruptcy. It doesn't bother me. It confuses other people. What you do is as I proposed, exactly what I proposed. You look at the situation, as you would look at a company that's gone into bankruptcy, and you say, well, this thing's got to survive. We've got to keep this thing alive. It's needed for the community. It's useful. It has a lot of potential. Mistakes were made. Oversights were occurred. We've got to rebuild this thing. So you're going to negotiate hardball with the creditors and others. And I'm used to that. I used to enjoy that. So what you do then is you simply get the creditors hardball, say, well, if you guys try to move in on this, you're going to get nothing on the dollar. That's my first point. They growl and snarl a bit and so forth. And I said, but I don't care how much you snarl and growl, that's the situation. You're not going to get anything out of this unless you go along with us. This thing can be rebuilt. You can salvage something out of the whole mess. Isn't that better than nothing? And you start from there. Now, they were in that kind of situation for the U.S. economy. And you've got, for example, you've got these golden parachutes. That doesn't, there's no honor in that piece of thievery. And so forth. So therefore, you look at what you start with is you start with the people. And you start with people, ordinary people, human beings. Because that's the individual human being is what's the most important thing. Because that's the human being is sovereign. That is, a human being has creative powers which exist only in the sovereign human being. It's what makes them a human being as opposed to being an animal. So the first thing you're out to do is to defend the human being as a human being. You know, he's in a community or he's in a firm in a community. You want to defend that if you can. So you protect that, number one. In order to make that work, you've got to think about the community in which this is going to happen. Then you've got to think about the enterprise you're dealing with and what is actually required. What are the elements that are actually required to make this thing successful again? And that's what you do. What about the things that don't fit those categories? Well, let me tell you. We've got to talk about this. And that's exactly the way you do it. Most of the claims against the dollar will never be honored. If they try to get them honored now, they will get nothing in the end. If they're willing to go along with a settlement which lets everybody live, they can do quite nicely. They may not like it, but it's the only real option they have. Now, this is why government comes in. Who's the best arguer on these things? Who's the best litigant on these kinds of things? Government, the power of sovereign government is the only instrument that can sort out a mess like this. So therefore, we're going to put these guys through bankruptcy. And most of these guys, like, you know, Mayor Bloomberg, never earned a nickel in his life. He says he's got $40 billion. And he wants to steal more. He's not going to case with me. He's going to give. He's not going to take, as far as I'm concerned. So that's the point. It is a harsh, a national bankruptcy when you've got, know you've got out there implicitly claims in the order of magnitude of hundreds of trillions of dollars. And you look at the actual national product of each and all combined nations of the world today in terms of physical product. How are you going to pay off those quadrillions? You're not going to pay those quadrillions off. How did you pay off the Reichsmarks or the marks 1923. You're never going to pay them off. We are now in a hyperinflationary explosion. The U.S. dollar, if you have on a free market, is implicitly worth almost nothing. It's essentially wiped out. You're just waiting for the executioner to come along and do the job of taking the head off. So therefore, before that happens, you have to organize the thing and say, okay, we're not going to take, nobody's going to take an average cut on this thing. We're going to decide what will survive and what will not. First of all, people must survive. That's your first standard. Secondly, the most productive features of society, which are central to productive features of society, must survive. Everything else is up for grabs.
We got a note from one of the writers over at Truth Out, which is a website, saying that that they just posted a piece on the fact that Governor Spitzer was in the process of launching a significant initiative against predatory lending. And the author suggests that this may, in fact, also be involved in the targeting of him. So we will, in fact, take a look at that, and we thank you for calling that to our attention. Lynn, the next question is from a Democratic staffer on the House Education and Labor Committee. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, do you think that if Hillary Clinton were elected, that this would mean that fascism could not be imposed?
Well, in a case like that, if she were elected, she would have my full support and assistance in dealing with just that problem. She's not a fascist. I mean, Hillary's not that. She doesn't fit the profile. Other people do. Or they fit the profile of people who would go along with it, like many Germans did. They weren't fascists. They just went along with it. They prevented. They couldn't see the smokestacks. That's all. So you have people who don't want to see the smokestacks of fascism. But Hillary is not a fascist. I mean, I at this stage can read her from a distance very well, not in every respect, but I have a clear sense of what her character is, including the things I have found not the best or most useful in her, and things that are the most useful. She's essentially an honest person. She also is an honest person who's trying to adapt to a society in which there's a premium on opportunism. And that is a problem these days. I think there are very few people in society, especially in politics, who are not victims of a large dose of opportunism, which they think is the only way to get ahead in this operation. She has shown that, in a sense, her whole campaign at one point of the emphasis on feminism was opportunism. She was not thinking about the country as such, even though she was, in one sense. But she was thinking about the cause of having a woman president and the changes in society that implied. But that's running away from the real issue. Instead of, why don't we just think, if you want women to have better status in life, why not think of them as human beings? And there's still a lot of people who aren't capable of doing that, even women, in terms of practice. So therefore you start to think about what is needed. What is the action by government which is going to set a standard which raises the level of the condition of people, including women? What's your mission for the future of humanity? You know, we live in a society that pretends it's very religious. And I think it's sometimes stupidity is mistaken for a religion. But they don't believe in the immortality of man. Not in any meaningful sense. They have some magic place. You go to some other department and get treated nicely, as opposed or you get cured of your old age or something. But the human being, as I keep emphasizing to people, is essentially immortal, as no animal is. And a human being who's qualified to lead human beings is one who has a sense of immortality, in that sense. The sense is, what do you do for humanity? What does your life mean for humanity in times to come? What will be immortal about what you've done with your life? in terms of the future of humanity. And it's only people who think like that who are capable of responding to a crisis of the type. No. I think Hillary's capable of that. I think Bill, in a sense, is also capable of that. I think that's his underlying, bottom line, morality. I think in the short term, he's very capable of being opportunist, as Hillary was. But I don't think that they would... I think they would reject the idea of becoming anything other than that. They would reject the idea of not looking at what your life is doing for humanity after you're dead. They would reject anything like that. I mean, for example, parents used to think about their daughters like that. Like Hillary, I mean, Chelsea is probably treated that way by Hillary and by Bill. That's their future. Huh? And they would look at their daughter and look at what their daughter's life is before her and look at that as an expression of the future of humanity, an expression of the outgrowth of their own lives and mission in life. And that's the way it has to be looked at. Otherwise, and I think she does have that quality. I don't think it's perfected, but so what? I can't find many people in whom it is.
Caitlin, another question that's been submitted by one of the directors of one of the presidential campaigns. Mr. LaRouche, you repeatedly refer to your youth movement and the role that they're playing in forwarding your political agenda. And I think we are all very familiar with them here in Washington. Yet, in what would seem to be something of an anomaly, those under the age of 22 or 23 are voting overwhelmingly for Barack Obama. Please explain this, because it would seem to me to be a contradiction in terms, and it disturbs me.
Well, this is like the question of education. Don't blame the young people for their own mistakes. Blame the people who are educating them or influencing the way they think. We find, for example, in the age group between 25 and 35, I find the highest degree of relative achievement in morality and otherwise. I find in the generation, for example, 14 to 18, I find the greatest propensity for creating terrorists in the United States today from among those who play too much on video games. They're the most susceptible. Around the world, that seems to be 14 to 18 is the age interval which is most likely to produce the greatest number of usable terrorists who can be deployed by the companies which run the games, which is how it works. You're on the games, you're 14 to 18, you're an adolescent, you're not a young adult, you're an adolescent. The company that creates the game is running the game while you're playing it. The company that runs the game is keeping a record of your play and your identity every time you play it. The company that runs the game is orchestrating the game to affect you, to give you frustrations, and to read your reactions. The company that runs the game now has a tally through the age of psychologists and sociologists to determine which kid is likely to be ready to be sent out to commit a shoot-and-die operation. So you look at the attention span of the young people between 14 and 18 and 18 and 20 and 22, 23. Look at them. What's their concentration span? How long is the sentence they can keep their attention on? Is it 10 words? Is it 5 words? Or 2? I want... Therefore, we have built up a terrorist potential inside the United States, which is comparable to what people experience in the Islamic center, south of the world, and related parts of the world. There, it's done one way. Here, it's done with video games. Here and in Europe, it's done largely with video games. The video game players are the greatest source of mass terrorist action comparable to the mass terrorist action you're seeing in Southwest Asia. Your attention span is very short. Now you get a little older. And you now think about, what does this mean? What about somebody who's between 25 and 35 years of age? What's different? Well, they became adult in the course of the period between two terms of office of George W. Bush. What happened in that period? What happened to life opportunity? Think of the economic circumstances of life. Think of the expectation. Think of what happens on universities. Think of what's happening in high schools. Do you realize that while you're sitting there and looking at the way the society is going to hell and you're not doing a damn thing about it? Then you want to blame the 14 to 18-year-old kid who's your prospective mass killer who'll go out and kill 22 people and then shoot himself at the sign game over. You're producing him. Why? Because you're tolerating George W. Bush and what he represents. So you're allowing with your mass education, with your mass entertainment, with your programs, you're taking the younger part of the youth generation, the adolescent, and the younger adults, and you're destroying them by the kind of cultural environment you're creating around them. And to some degree, you're deliberately orchestrating it. And the other thing, you just insulate them against any sensitivity of reality. The basic character of these kids is they're not in the real universe. The basic character of MySpace and Facebook is the people who are conditioned to that are no longer in the real universe. They're in an artificial universe. They're in electronic, they're not in real space, they're in electronic space. They're making up identities. They're telling lies and sharing their lies. They're arguing in a way that has no cognitive content. They're acting like mice in a cage, an experimental cage. Of course that. What we're depending upon in this organization, in the LIM, we are depending upon a certain selection of young people, especially concentrating in the 25 to 35-year age bracket. Young people who have the problems which they experience, the social, cultural problems, psychological problems, which are produced by this society. But within that age group, we find a scientific capability among these people which exceeds that of the typical university graduate today. And we program it in the sense of we have these task orientations. We have the task orientation on the fundamentals of science, from the ancient Greek Pythagoreans on, through the work of people like Riemann, Einstein, Vygotsky, and so forth. And because if you have that orientation to that seriously, you really understand that. You're really able to get the concepts as opposed to a blab response that passes the test or something. Smart answer on the test, but really know it. Then you have the intellectual character and confidence and sense of identity, which is needed to get some of the sophistry out of the older generation of this society. You will find that young people in this category, this special category, two qualifications, age group, which is an advantage, being a part of that age group which is oriented toward science in a real sense, not how to pass a course, but how to make discoveries, the discoveries like the historic ones. You have a factor, which is the only factor we have, the best factor we have, of leading this society out of the garbage pail in which it's now dwelling.
For those of you who are listening via the internet, you're listening to a live webcast from Washington, D.C., being conducted by the American economist and statesman Lyndon LaRouche. Lynn, this next question is from the audience. It's from Ali Parabakowski. And the question is regarding the proposed four-power agreement between Russia, China, India, and the United States. And the question is, what is the historic and cultural background of these nations? Specifically, what is it that allows them to be the best combination to change the current world system?
Simple. It's me. No, what do I represent and what do these nations see in what I represent? I found in China that with the current government in China is concerned about issues which I'm concerned about, for China and for us. I'm concerned about the long-term cooperation between China and the United States in particular. I'm a long-standing advocate of India since I had served in military service over there for a while, at the end of the last war. And Russia, I also know very well, in my way. And I have relations with leading Russians, not everyone, but a number of them, enough to, and they know me, at least fairly well. And they also, combined with the United States, represent the dominant power on this planet today. The combination of the United States, Russia, China, and India are the major nations who, with the neighbors who want to work with them, are the dominant power on the planet today. Therefore, if you can assemble an alliance of this type among such a group of nations, the rest of the world knows that we have the power. And people, being as they are, will come knocking at our door and say, can we get in? And we will say, yes, you can get in, as equals. And that's the way to rebuild the world.
Caitlin, the next question has been submitted by Carlos Cano, who is the president of the Consumel World Organization. Mr. LaRouche, why do you persist in restructuring the old neoliberal model when those tendencies keep us from a new world order to be able to save the Earth from climatic changes through responsible consumption?
Well, see, first of all, I start from the principle in answer to this question, which, of course, will come up from many people in many forms, but it will all be the center of the same question. First of all, we are human beings. There is no such thing in my work as the neoliberal or liberal model. I don't want it. I want no part of it. I'm against liberalism, against neoliberalism. There are afflictions of humanity. I have nothing to do with either of them, so don't worry about that. On the other hand, I think that people are unwilling to understand the essential nature of humanity requires an emphasis on what is essentially scientific progress, revolutionary scientific progress, which means increase in what we called by some former Soviet scientists and now Russian scientists still, as increase of the energy flux density of applied sources of power. That means nuclear power. If you're not for nuclear power, you're not in the real universe. Because the nature of humanity is that the size of the population of the planet, now compare that with the gorilla or the orangutan, the swinging orangutan. That's why he has so many broken bones. He swings too much. People should take a lesson from that. Or the chimpanzee, that these beasts and man, we would think, would have a similar potential population density on the planet. And if we were merely, if we were environmentalists, we would be like baboons, maybe nicer, but not as violent as baboons. We have three, baboon coming with three baobab nuts under his armpits and one in his teeth. That's a good picture of that. But we are immortal in the sense that no animal is, because we are able to increase the potential population density of the human species, increase its life expectancy as well if individuals, in such a way that the individual who lives, who participates in this process, has the immortality of effect on coming generations. He's not just a thing that comes and dies. He's not a dead dog in the passing. And the human being has a creative power which exists in no animal species. The ability to make fundamental discoveries of natural principle. No animal can do that. Every animal has a relatively determined and predetermined potential population density. Mankind is not so limited. mankind is capable of increasing the population of the planet from a few millions to today's 7.5 or 6.5 billion. And we can go further. So man, and living longer. Mankind can do that. And if mankind stops doing that, man turns back into an animal. The problem with the environmentalist or the neo-Malthusian is that by intention, he's an animal, not a human being. Because on the one hand, he opposes doing what human beings do. On the second thing, he becomes an obstacle to other people trying to do what human beings do. So he passes rules and says that high technology shall not be introduced to society. We shall go back to a simple-minded society, like that of a monkey or baboon or something. And that's the problem. Give up this thing, this idea of this Malthusian conception. It's an enemy doctrine. It's been the enemy of humanity as far back as we know. It's the doctrine of the Zeus, Olympian Zeus, of the Prometheus bound. Prohibit man from discovering the principle of fire, and thus reduce man to an animal. I'm all for technological progress, especially scientific progress.
Okay, Lynn, this was submitted by several EIR readers and others. Lynn, Dick Cheney is going to 5 to 6 countries in Southwest Asia, and many people fear the Iran war or other preventive war is being set up. It is especially the case after the resignation of Admiral Fallon. What is your assessment of this region, and how do you think the U.S. can avoid war before the presidential elections?
Well, get rid of Nancy Pelosi, then maybe you'll get rid of Cheney. Nancy Pelosi has protected Cheney. The Congress was ready to impeach Cheney. And if Bush objected, to impeach him too. Huh? After the most recent midterm election. If you want to stop Cheney, impeach him. But to impeach him, you've got to get rid of Nancy Pelosi. And Nancy Pelosi is the trained puppy dog of a fascist called Felix Rohatyn. So Cheney is not your problem. Cheney is Mrs. Cheney's dog. And it's a poor specimen of dog at that. And she's owned by the British establishment. Maybe you should impeach the Queen of England. So that's the problem. Don't try to say what can we pick a little thing and fix it. The engine is not there. Don't try to fix the transmission.
Okay, I'm going to take a question from the audience if she's here. Vu, are you here? Where? Vu, do you want to ask your question? Go ahead.
Hi, Lynn. As you and for those who have listened to you enough have a sense of this is hell on earth we live in, and there's reason to that is within our educational system dated back then. It's the nature of our educational system is it's nothing different than a living habitat policy. Therefore, what is your ideas of our future educational systems that based on morality and creativity?
Well, first of all, there are two aspects of creativity. They're really the same thing, but they take a different target. One is the discovery of universal physical principles, by which man is able to change the universe to make the universe better for man's life. The same power of creativity, which is expressed by fundamental discoveries, such as those of, for example, Kepler or Leibniz or Riemann or and so forth, that these are really a reflection of the same kind of creativity which occurs in great classical art. And also in question of social relations as such. In physical science, you're looking at dynamics because you're looking at the universe, actually. Because if universe means universal principles. And universal principles mean your point of reference is the universe, as we define it. But then the principle of creativity, which is different than that of the animal, is based on the same mental powers applied to social relations. And social relations mean music and so forth. The two combined should combine to the effect of seeing oneself as immortal. That is, to seeing oneself as living, who's going to die, but doing something now which is going to be a fruit which the people before you, who live before you, will respect and benefit from, and to contribute something for future generations to come. So therefore, great classical art is of that form. It's to communicate the idea of what it is to be a human being from a lower state of condition of life to a better condition of life in which you have more ability to think about the future of humanity and to do things for the future of humanity. So one is love of humanity as such, the latter, art. The first is the love of the universe in its physical capacity. The two things are the same kind of creativity which exists in man but not in the apes. Therefore, that's the policy. Love of mankind as such, and love of mankind's mastery of the universe as such, is the basis of a healthy culture. Because if we don't advance scientifically, then what happens is, by using up the kind of resources which are on the surface, we go to a lower state of existence, and humanity degenerates because we have not improved our technologies. If we've improved our technologies, then the attrition caused by using up this or that resource or depleting it is defeated. And the sense of triumph in saying, we have today done something which means that our children can live and can live a better life than we had. And to think about the ways we organize our relations to accomplish that's culture. But we have today we teach people to behave. To behave. By somebody's standard. My problem is how to teach people who set the standards how to behave. I mean it. Take the people who, the big pompous asses, who want to set the standard for the rest of us to behave. And I want to teach them, for a turn, how to behave.
The next question is from a well-known Democratic consultant. He says, Lynn, I like to think of myself as an optimistic guy, but frankly, I'm very worried. He's worried. The current race for the Democratic nomination is being orchestrated in such a way as to cause bitter divisions among Democrats. And my fear is that those divisions may be too bitter and too deep to be mended. It's ironic. Barack Obama is portrayed as the candidate who brings new layers into the process and who can unify the party. But it has been people behind the Obama candidacy that have taken actions that have been the most divisive. If this continues, I'm afraid that we face the possibility of a GOP victory. I think that this is partially what you're referring to when you talk about the whole Bloomberg scenario, but I'm not sure. Given the pace of current events, I do believe that the world is likely to be a very different place when the Democratic Convention takes place, and I take some heart in that fact. But do you think that there is some efficient way to deal with this problem now?
Oh, I certainly do believe there is an efficient way to deal with this problem now, and I've been trying to do it today, for example. First of all, understand that Felix Rohatyn is implicitly not only a fascist, which he is explicitly, but also is implicitly a fascist and a traitor to the United States. Now, I'm sure that if you get that idea across, don't worry about Obama so much. Obama is just a fool, politically. He has nothing to offer, has offered nothing. He just had a lot of people that played with an image, like people masturbating with a doll. That's what it amounts to. There's no substance to the man. He hasn't said anything that has any substance. And all these people are saying he's great. Why do they say he's great? Because there's nothing there to criticize. He takes no position on anything. Probably need all in sex. I don't know. So what I have said, if you say that Felix Rohatyn, and you understand what that means, that Felix Rohatyn is not only a fascist, and anybody who works with him and follows his line is also a fascist, a recruit to fascism, like Nancy Pelosi. If you say that Nancy Pelosi is not qualified to be a fascist, but she's been recruited to a fascist movement, you got it precisely. Or a fascist non-movement, if the Teds in her face are tightened up too much. Huh? So if you say that Rohatyn is implicitly a traitor to the United States, and say it loud and clear and make it clear, your problem is solved. If you say that Obama is merely a guy who's been set up and is going to be pulled down by these guys because they want a fascist called the mayor of New York in, you made it very clear. If you don't say these things, then you leave the field open for the fascists. So the ability to tell the truth rather than worrying about popularity of sophist explanations, that's the problem. And as I've said today, I'm saying implicitly that Felix Rohatyn is not only a fascist, which he is beyond doubt. He's a fascist just like Mussolini and the Hitler movement, the same. No difference whatsoever. He's not only a fascist and a British agent, which he is, Laissez Faire, British agent, but he also is a traitor to the United States. And I don't believe that we should support a traitor to the United States controlling the Democratic Party. And I don't think we should have a Nancy Pelosi as leader of the Speaker of the House who is controlled by a fascist and an implicit traitor to the United States. I don't think that her judgment on what should happen in the House of Representatives is trustworthy. And I think we're idiots if we tolerate it. I condemn her, and you say, well, it's not nice to condemn her. Why not condemn her? She's condemnable. She's a condemnable structure, despite the intentions that are put on to keep her face from falling out.
If we had more housing inspectors, she would be condemned. Lynn, I'm going to ask you this question because I'm not sure exactly what accounts for this, but we have six questions that have been submitted on this topic. They're all almost identical. Five of them are from Italy, and one is from an Italian university student in Buenos Aires. The question is Mr. LaRouche, as I'm sure you know, the former finance minister of Italy, Giulio Tremonti, has recently written a book on the end of globalization and the need for a new Bretton Woods. Unfortunately, Tremonti is part of a political movement, the Berlusconi movement, in which many are part of the old P2 networks. They also support a platform which is racist, xenophobic, and generally deplorable. How do you think this contradiction is going to be resolved? Exactly 30 years ago, Aldo Moro was kidnapped and killed by this network. Could you please comment on what is behind Tremonti's actions?
I think Tremonti is a professional who knows what he's saying and knows what he's proposing and believes in it. But he's also in Italy, which has not been able to have a government which Italians have controlled for some time, because foreign powers have controlled it from the outside by pulling strings, chiefly London. and you take the case of the Morrow case, who is guilty in the Morrow case? Well, you could ask Henry Kissinger about that because he knows something about that. But Henry Kissinger didn't do it. London did it. And Italy has been under the control since the British yacht, Britannia, hovered off the coast of Italy. And a bunch of people went out there and set up a policy. So don't look at a particular government or a particular party to understand things in Italy. You have to look at the fact that you have a country which doesn't like being controlled from the outside, but which is controlled from the outside. You have a country which is dominated by Americans and Brits in various places, such as Bellagio, which is the Rockefeller headquarters in Italy, which is located in other cities, have the same kind of thing. So what people like he are trying to operate within an immoral society. The British, actually, in the post-war, the post-Soviet period, broke up the parties of Italy. So to reduce them till they have no real power to control themselves. Or if the government of Italy tries to do something, what did the British do? Well, sometimes with American assistance. They caused the fall of the government. They ensure that no party is strong enough to be a government. My view of the matter, and I look at this as I look at it in Europe, and I look at it as Helga and I look at it, Europe, the nations of Europe have been disenfranchised. Every nation of continental Europe, from Portugal to the Belarus and so the Russian border, have been ruined. They have no power as such. They could get some catalytically, but they're all controlled. Look, you have the structure of this thing. Thatcher, the Nancy Pelosi of her time. Thatcher was the vehicle for dictating what became known as a policy, which was imposed upon the Maastricht policy, which was imposed on Germany as the same kind of policy imposed by the British and the Versailles powers back in the 1920s. Same kind of policy. Germany was told the condition of reunification was that it destroy its industrial and agricultural potentiality, that it destroy its scientific potentiality. And they did it on orders with support of the United States. A similar thing was done to Italy. A similar thing was attempted with partial success in France. All of Europe have been deprived of their absolute sovereignty. Now, they might get it back, as Helga is trying to assist that process. If they reject the Lisbon strategy, a strategic policy, if they reject that policy, then Europe would be in a position to get some of its freedom back under present conditions. But no nation of Western and Central Europe has any sovereignty whatsoever today. And therefore, Tremonti is operating in a domain where Italy is not allowed to actually exercise actual sovereignty. So the struggle is to struggle for certain ideas and certain try to influence the process. It's an intellectual process of attempted defense. But without our intervention in the world scene from the United States, with the cooperation of Russia, China, and India, Western continental Europe will not be free. It will be what it is today, simply a colony of the British.
Okay, this is the last question, and this comes from somebody who was a superdelegate at the Democratic Convention in Boston. And this person says, Mr. LaRouche, 4 years ago, you and your organization launched an intervention into the Democratic Convention in Boston that almost saved the day. Unfortunately, while it didn't win the election, there's no doubt in my mind that it laid the basis for holding things together in the aftermath of the election, and certainly in the victory that Democrats scored in the fight to save Social Security. I'm very tempted to ask you what your plans are for this year's convention in Denver, but I'm going to ask you a very different question. The question that I ask you is this: how does evil manifest itself in individuals?
Well, it's a matter of degree, actually. When you actually say you want to screw a certain part of the human population, you're on the road to evil. Because, you know, in dealing with problem cases as individuals and so forth in society, you sometimes throw up your hands and say, this case is impossible. But you really don't wish evil to be done to these people. You just wish they hadn't become what they're like. But in general, your concern is extended to individual by case. But really, it's toward the future of humanity. I mean, here I am, I'm 85 years of age. What am I doing at 85 years of age? What am I based on? Well, what I'm based on is the outcome of a generation which is now largely between 25 and 35 years of age. Because that generation is going to determine whether we have a future or not, for all of us. And thus, you work that way. And that's the way you avoid evil. Now, what you have to do, of course, is the other side is, you know, it becomes a religious question, but the religious question is not a religious question in the way that some foolish people like to talk about religion, because what they talk about is their own fantasy life, not reality. Reality is, you know, take as I've done often enough, take the first chapter of Genesis, which is a very interesting work, a very remarkable work, because it says something which is said in a metaphorical way. But if you think about what I know about the universe and mankind, what it says is true. Especially the part about man and woman. And I'm a real authority. That man and woman have a quality which is absent in any form of animal life. It is the power to change the universe. Not all at once, or not with lightning strokes or something like that, but by making discoveries and acting on those discoveries for the benefit of civilization, the benefit of the universe, in fact. This characteristic, unlike that of any animal, is a quality which is transmitted from a living person to coming generations. What you do in the way of adding to human knowledge, of creative knowledge, like a discovery of scientific principles or the realization or implementation of a discovery which needs to be implemented for the sake of future humanity, that lives on. It lives on as an embedded part of humanity, such that the individual may die as a biological specimen, but what they contribute to society does not die. It does not simply live as something to be remembered. But as in school, it is relived as something, a discovery re-experienced, or action re-experienced by coming generations, which becomes the foundation of their further progress in humanity. In that sense, in a very real sense, in a very practical sense, the human individual who accepts that kind of role in life is immortal. The flesh dies, but the contribution to humanity does not. And the main business of society is to ensure that people who make that contribution, that their contribution is not wasted, is not lost. If that is rejected, someone says, we are going to be the boss. We are going to make it. These other guys, they're going to go. Who cares about them? Look, they're schnooks. That's evil. That's the beginning of evil. And when you start from that, and then you say, well, I enjoy killing these people. I enjoy doing this to them. They deserve it. Ha, ha, ha. Now you got evil. And there's a lot of it. That's Cheney, for example. That's his wife. That's what Pelosi is doing. Pelosi is, with all her stupidity, and she certainly is abundantly gifted in that department, is nonetheless not so stupid that she doesn't have some awareness of what she's doing. Therefore, she's acting out of evil motives. The evil motive is to be a thing for an evil man, Felix Rotten. Huh? That's the problem. So therefore, there is such a thing as evil. But the problem is that people try to simplify this thing in terms of comic book strip kind of things. These cheap shot explanations, like something like Harry Potter or something. And they make a farce out of something which is actually a discoverable universal principle, that mankind is not an animal. We have an animal body, but there's something else about us, something more important, which doesn't die. Or shouldn't be allowed to die. And that is the contribution that the human being can make and no other animal can make to the future of humanity and to the future of the universe. And it's the denial of that which is the essential evil.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that brings today's proceedings to a close. Clearly we have a long road ahead, but a clear path to take. For those of you who are listening via the internet, I would urge you, if you have not already done so, to contribute the maximum that you can contribute to the LaRouche PAC so that we can continue our efforts. I'd like to thank those of you here in the audience. You've been a wonderful audience. And I'd like to ask you now, finally, to join me in thanking Lynn for a remarkable presentation.
Thank you, young lady. You have fun. You think Bill had fun? You made the screen.